Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Chris Cervell. I represent AJW, who is the father of the oldest of the two daughters that the mother had. I'd like to focus my argument initially on what I believe to be error by the trial court in admitting Exhibit 401. This was a criminal complaint against my client, the father, in an unrelated alleged incident. Extremely prejudicial, and the court admitted that into evidence. Initially, the court made no preliminary determination under Rule 104 of the Rules of Evidence that any crime had occurred, that the father had committed any of these alleged acts, and so there was no preliminary determination.
Counsel, can you tell me the purpose for which the document was admitted?
I can't, Your Honor. I think the only purpose was to snare my client.
Well, doesn't the fact of a pending criminal case, merely that fact in the abstract, doesn't that seem relevant?
I think it's
quite apart from the acts that gave rise to it.
I don't think it's relevant to the to any material fact in the dependency or neglect case.
It doesn't bear on your client's ability to care for the child.
That allegations have been made?
The criminal case is pending, so there's at least a theoretical possibility of criminal conviction.
Well, I think that may be the point. There's a theoretical possibility of it, but until people are presumed innocent, until proven guilty, there was not shred of evidence that any of this of these allegations actually occurred.
Okay.
And under 404B, and the Spoto test, the prejudice clearly outweighed any theoretical relevancy that this may have had. In fact, the Spoto case makes clear that there's a forbidden inference here, that if he was alleged to have done these bad acts, then you can infer that he's a bad person and did something bad in this case. That's the prohibited inference that Spoto says protect against. That's exactly what happened here. It was to convince the jury that he's a bad guy because of allegations without a shred of evidence. I'd like to hear from the people where in the record there was any evidence submitted that these allegations were true. No witnesses were called at all regarding this. At any point in time, the allegations were just admitted. So initially under 104 of the Rules of Evidence, the court had an obligation to make a preliminary determination that at least, you know, there's some factual basis for this. That was never done. And keep in mind that these are they're criminal charges, they're not facts, they're not evidence. It's not testimony from a witness saying, well, I saw him do this.
Mr. Sue, how do you pronounce your name?
Cervelled.
Cervelled. Assuming that the trial court abused its discretion in admitting this evidence, why would it not be harmless error?
Because it was extremely prejudicial, and
there was also evidence, if I remember correctly, of another allegation by the mother against your client. Is that correct?
There were allegations about that.
So would this second, the allegation that you've been describing to us, be cumulative, or was it particularly prejudicial for some reason?
It was particularly prejudicial. If you look at Exhibit 401, made allegations of felony menacing, assault with a deadly weapon, impersonating a police officer, a bias-motivated crime. And that's exactly what the people argued on closing argument, that, hey, these criminal allegations have been filed against this guy. And I think the jury was persuaded that that was somehow relevant, that those facts had actually occurred. Anyway, additionally, under the Spoto test, there was no independent hypothesis of why this was relevant ever articulated. And in fact, the court refused my offer to admit other pleadings in that criminal case that showed my client's side of the story. said, no, those would not be admitted. So what's sauce for the goose is not sauce for the gander in this case for some reason. I think it eventually was very prejudicial to my client. The other issue, if I may address, is the issue of this inconsistent verdict.
Mr. Cervell, your time is up.
Okay.
So unless my colleagues...
Do we have any questions on that?
Thank you. Thank you. We appreciate your argument.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Brian Kidney, registration number 23256. I'm appearing today on behalf of ALR, who's the mother of the two children. I wanted to delve into the I'll call it the child hearsay statute, 1325.129. And one point I wanted to make, under the Bowers case, and I think a mistake the trial judge made, the court has to make three findings. One of the findings is, why is this child incompetent? And I want the court to remember the child was 3 years old, just 3 years old, when these allegations were made. And everybody stipulated that the child was incompetent. So the child was not called in an in-camera hearing.
Your incompetence means unavailable to testify.
Well, it goes a little further than that. Right. Unavailable under 1325.129, the child hearsay statute, unavailability can mean incompetence. What does incompetence mean for a child? There've been appellate court cases that have said a child doesn't need to understand an oath. A child may not need to know the difference between truth or a false statement. So it's a much lower standard than competency for an adult. But the court still needs to make a determination of the child's competency, because here's the challenge, or here's the question for competency for a child. Can the child receive and understand a just impression of facts? And that wasn't made by the trial court.
Did you ask the trial court to make that specific determination?
I think I did, and I'll quote you to the January 4th transcript, and that's pages 132 and 133. And I think the trial court was confused. The trial court kind of asked the question that you asked me. Well, the child's unavailable. I just need to make a ruling they're incompetent. That makes them unavailable. No. If it's a one-year-old, and that one-year-old is incompetent, that doesn't mean their hearsay statements get in. There still has to be a finding, the minimum level of competency for a child. They don't have to know an oath. They may not be, well, they can crumble on the stand, but they have to be able to relate just impressions of fact. That wasn't made, and I specifically asked the court that.
Mr. Kidney, are there cases in which the appellate courts have said that a child who is below a certain age could not provide testimony under 1325.129?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, although I've done a fair amount of research on the Child Hearsay Act, and this child was just three. That's the youngest I've seen admitted.
Counsel, why isn't the question about the child's ability to relay a just impression of fact not necessarily bound up and cumulative to the determination of reliability under 1325.129?
Yeah, that's interesting, because I suppose you could say, and I think that's maybe what the judge thought, I don't need to determine if the child, I don't need to make a ruling about the competency, because I'm going to look at the reliability and whether there is corroborative evidence. And I guess you can make that argument, but that's not what Bowers says. Bowers says make all three arguments, and that's a Supreme Court case. That says, tell us why the child is incompetent, give us indications of reliability, and give us corroborative evidence.
Within the context of Bowers, doesn't the incompetence or competence relate solely to availability or unavailability?
No, I don't think so, Judge.
Okay.
Let me quote that. I've got a quote here straight from Bowers. We further agree with the Court of Appeals that in keeping with 1325.129, the trial court should have specified the reason why it found KB, the child, not competent to testify.
Okay.
So it's a separate issue from reliability and corroboration. And the court didn't do that. In the brief, I also talk about the reliability and corroboration requirements. I think that's laid out pretty well there.
I wanted to make one other point. I don't think, unless the court has any other questions. Okay. I don't think the special advocate, excuse me, the child and family investigator should have been allowed to testify. Remember, my client, ALR, was involved in a domestic relations case with Mr. Cervell's client, AEW. In that domestic relations case, that was just one child involved in that. AEW is the child, AJW is Mr. Cervell's client. A CFI was appointed in the domestic relations case, Montrose County District Court. That CFI made findings. And then what triggered this domestic relations case is the CFI said there could be some credible allegations of abuse. So we then went into a dependence neglect case. Mr. Cervell then tried to call the CFI as an expert witness, basically for the father. If you look at the CFI directives, the Colorado State Judicial Directives, I'll finish up with some, if I can finish this thought.
Thank you.
Go ahead. A CFI shall not have inconsistent dual roles. And here, remember, CFI is a unique creature. It's created by statute. A CFI is not an expert for any party. A CFI is appointed by the court under 1410.116.5. It has unprecedented access to all the parties. That standard CFI order says the parties have to provide medical releases, complete disclosure, and then a report's given to the court. I think it smells bad and also violates the Chief Justice directives. Here's what happened to my client. There's an expert appointed by the court in the domestic relations case. Remember, my client has two children. Then in the dependency and neglect case, the CFI comes in, parlays her court appointment into testifying against my client in a case where she could possibly lose, have her parental rights terminated for a second child.
I think your time is up now. Thank you, Mr. Kidney. We appreciate it.
My name is Susan Baker. I represent the respondent father, FMS. His child is ACM. Our argument is there was absolutely no evidence presented during the adjudicatory hearing that ACM was abused or neglected in any way. She was not without proper care, no past or present evidence. And I asked the court to focus on jury instructions 10 and 13 and the combination of those instructions. Our belief is that the jury became confused and adjudicated ACM as to my client, FMS, and remember he was not found in the special jury verdict to have abused or neglected his daughter. Only two findings were made, that she was without proper parental care and that she was out without proper care. And as the record indicates, the jury was very confused by that special verdict form. They asked questions about it. And I'd ask the court to consider the effect of that no-fault provision being added to the forum. I think that's argued in Mr. Cervell's brief primarily, the effect of that along with these two jury instructions. Jury instruction 13 says that when deciding whether a child is mistreated or abused, or whether the child lacks proper parental care, the jury may consider the treatment of other children. And then combined with jury instruction 10, the jury was allowed to infer about prospective harm. Now, the statutes are clear that in a DNA case, prospective harm is an important issue, but it's fact-specific. I direct the court to the XMS case, which has been cited by opposing counsel, and also to the DLR case. In XMS, a child was clearly sexually abused by her father, removed, so there was a past act, presently in foster care. And the question that the jury was going to be hung up on based on the facts was whether if she was returned home to her father in the future, there was a potential for abuse. So clearly the instruction about past or present acts equals future problem, potential future problem, was appropriate. And the court in XM, gave other instructions, including the injurious environment instruction, which the court noted helped the jury understand the full picture. There were cautionary instructions that helped alleviate the problem of speculative future harm based on no past or present harm at all. In the DLR case, you had a schizophrenic mother. So again, the likelihood of her having problems in the future was factually based. It warranted the instruction. In this case, again, there is absolutely no evidence of past or present harm. And the instruction says, this is instruction 10, you may consider evidence of prospective harm to the child or children when deciding the issues in this case. Likewise, words written in the present tense do not prevent you from considering evidence of a child's condition in the past. For example, you may consider evidence that a child lacked proper care in the past when determining whether the child lacks proper care. Again, it has to be based on the facts. I think the case law is clear, and in this case, this instruction was not warranted by the facts.
Well, Ms. Baker, here there was an allegation of sexual abuse against your client with regard to the other child, not his daughter. Could that be considered by the jury with regard to whether his own daughter was dependent or neglected?
That would have been addressed by jury instruction 13, and I'm not arguing that instruction alone is improper. I think how one sibling is treated could affect how another sibling is treated. But my problem is that we don't have anything about past or present. We have children of two separate fathers. They don't always live together. To me, it's very confusing to put these together, and the result is the jury comes up with a speculative adjudication that's not factually based, and that really goes back to sufficiency of the evidence in this case. And in the SGL case, I think the court addresses the fact that an adjudication is based upon not a parent's direct fault, but a parent can be found to not be, a parent cannot be adjudicated as demonstrated by SGL, even where another parent has been, and it becomes an issue of whether the treatment plan should apply to a parent. So even though there's an adjudication as to the child generally, whether a parent is at fault or part of that adjudication can be considered by the jury because it relates to whether a parent has to comply with the treatment plan.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. We appreciate your argument.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Sean Pierman. I represent JW and MW, which are the paternal grandparents to the oldest of the two children, which is the oldest child is AEW. We brought an appeal based on an order that the court issued prohibiting surveillance. And I would focus, ask the court to focus just specifically on, for purposes of this section of my argument, on the overbroad argument that we raised on page 11 of our brief. In the statute 19.3508.1e, there is the court has an ability to order a treatment plan. That's all it's got at that disposition stage where this order emanated from. And it's our position, not only based on the constitutional issues that we raised, that the court exceeded its authority, and this is an overbroad order, because this is not a treatment plan. The court has addressed this issue in other cases. In fact, I believe there's a case, it's People in the Interest of AH, which is 736 P. Second 425, I believe it's a Court of Appeals case, when it specifically recognized that the treatment plan purpose is to, it must be measured by its likelihood of success in reuniting the family. It's our position this overbroad order is one that does not have any purpose to point this to a reunification of the family. The other thing that's somewhat troubling is that it's not real clear what the surveillance means. I think the common definition probably applies, but the court didn't really clarify what surveillance is. But there had actually been hired surveillance, in other words, a private investigator. So there is some concern that that wasn't clearly defined, and it could mean that the grandparents are unable now to watch and testify later than against what they see during the visitation exchanges or even just the standard day-to-day contact with the child.
Mr. Pearman?
Yes.
Questions first. This argument that the order that was issued is not within the scope of the statute that was purportedly relied on, I don't see that in your brief.
And that's unfortunate that it wasn't specifically quoted, but we did mention in our brief that it was an overbroad order, and I think
it was a constitutional argument.
Yes, we did focus on constitutional arguments.
Okay. Second question. Mm-hmm. Where did you raise the constitutional arguments in the district court?
Well, this was not actually raised because this was an order at the dispositional hearing, so there was not an opportunity at the trial stage to raise this issue.
There's no post-trial motion, though. You could file a post-trial motion.
There was no post-trial motion. That's correct.
Okay.
And I really don't have anything further other than what's in the brief. I think that this would be an opportunity for the court to clarify what can be in an order for a treatment plan. It seems like there has been some cases that have come down addressing that issue. This is certainly unconstitutional in our opinion, and should be stricken. So,
Mr. Pearman, to the extent that you're arguing that the trial court's order was overbroad, did you ask for clarification as to whether or not it precluded your clients from reporting their own observations as opposed to hiring a private investigator?
Are you asking, did we file that motion?
Did you ask for any clarification from the trial court regarding the language of its order?
No, we did not.
It's pretty clear from context, isn't it, that the order is referring to the hired surveillance?
I believe that's true, yes. That was what this came from, and it would be easy to infer then from the court's order that they don't want surveillance, which is why we then argued the petition clause of the Constitution. So,
are you aware of any cases, one way or the other, that deal with surveillance in a DNN case?
We are not. The closest one we found was the California case that we cited, which seems to present some good authority and good reasoning behind it, which is the, I believe it's Tichinen case.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pearman. We appreciate your argument. Now we're ready to hear the arguments from the opposing side.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Amy Andos, registration number 36604, representing Montrose County in this case. I want to start briefly by responding to some of the issues addressed by the appellants. Some of the arguments they did make in their briefs, and some of them they did not. The issue starting in the order that they presented with Mr. Cervelle regarding the admitting the criminal cases, the criminal complaints under the rules of, under the federal rules of evidence. The purpose that those were admitted was because it was based on an expert report that initiated the entire dependency and neglect case. The expert in this case did use those criminal charges and those allegations against the father, A.W., in preparing her report. Her report, which was dated November 5th, 2011, was the precipitating element of the dependency and neglect case. It was that report and her mandatory reporting to the department that brought the CNN case and brought the whole thing. As a mandatory reporter and as an expert witness, she is entitled to use hearsay statements in order to form an opinion in drafting conclusions.
Can you explain the relevance? How are the criminal charges relevant in this determination?
Well, the criminal charges were relevant because they were used by her in a determination of whether or not the father could parent his child. The allegations made were extremely serious, included felony kidnapping and racial intimidation.
She assumed they were true.
I can't answer that she assumed that they were true. However, that she did use those in stating concerns about the parent, the father's ability to care, to care for the child.
So the relevance here depends not on the fact of a pending criminal case, but rather on the nature of the underlying allegations. Is that what you're telling us?
In my opinion, yes.
Are there any cases, one way or the other, that deal with the admissibility of just criminal charges in DNN cases?
I'm not aware of any specific to dependency and neglect cases. Mr. Cervell did mention the Spado case. That case does deal with, it is a criminal case.
Right.
And there are many criminal cases that deal with 404 issues. There aren't many that tie to the dependency and neglect world.
Okay, thank you.
Well, with respect to those complaints, what, if any, limiting instruction was given to the jury with respect to those?
There was a jury instruction given that did provide that a pending criminal charge was not necessarily a fact, and that even charges pending were not indicative that a crime had been committed.
Was the jury given any instruction as to the precise purpose for which those complaints could be considered?
I don't believe so. However, we did have several hearings where jury instructions were discussed, and the one instruction that was admitted was presented by Mr. Cervell. There weren't any other instructions presented regarding Rule 404. Concerning the child hearsay statements brought up by Mr. Kidney, he did cite the Bowers case and three findings were needed. However, it's clear in the People v. District Court of El Paso County, which is a Colorado Supreme Court case 776 P. 2nd 1083, that does outline factors regarding reliability of statements offered that the child had made. In that case, which I did cite in my brief and did list the factors that they included, they did state, and in the district court during the hearing, there were objections prior to the hearing regarding those statements coming in. However, the objections in the appeal briefs are not specific to which statements are being objected to. There were statements made by the child to three different people that were introduced at the trial court. None of those specific statements were addressed or objected to during the course of the trial or specifically mentioned in any of the appellant's appeal briefs. Regarding the issue brought up by Mr. Pierman concerning the surveillance, the court does have the authority to issue orders and dispositional orders regarding the welfare of the child. Mr. Pierman, there was no evidence presented at the trial, and there was no evidence in the appeal brief to determine how any paid surveillance was going to be beneficial to the welfare of the child.
So it's clear you agree that the court sort of refers to paid surveillance, right? We're talking about a hired private investigator, not doesn't purport to limit the grandparents' own observations, that kind of thing.
Correct. And I did address that issue off the record with Mr. Pierman. However, as the court indicated in their questions, he didn't file any type of post-trial motion. He didn't try to do anything to clarify that order of the court.
Ms. Andos, with regard to the surveillance, is the question that we need to address whether the surveillance would benefit the welfare of the child, or on the other hand, whether that evidence would somehow be detrimental to the welfare of the child?
Your Honor, I think the court here would need to determine whether there is any benefit or detriment to the child. I think if somebody's going to have paid surveillance, not only can it be inconvenient and annoying and harassing for the person who's being surveilled, but I think in order to do that, there has to be a purpose and a benefit.
Did the trial court here make any findings on those factors that you're just describing now?
No, Your Honor, and as you pointed out, there were no post-trial motions. Mr. Pierman did not make any objections at the time of the disposition hearing when that order was issued, and he had no request for any clarification of that order.
Can you explain what the court was thinking? Why do you think the court did what it did here?
There were two contempt motions filed against the respondent mother as well as her own mother, based on the private surveillance. One of those contempt motions was dismissed after the evidentiary hearing, January 31st through February 3rd. The second one was later set for a hearing and then eventually dismissed by Mr. Cervelle. So the court never addressed the issue of what the surveillance was for, but we do have evidence in the record that two contempt citations did come from that.
What evidence was there that the surveillance actually harmed anybody? I mean, you kind of turned it around and said, well, there was no evidence that it was beneficial, but why should a party have to show that surveillance is beneficial when you're restricting their rights? I mean, they have the right to do this. At the outset, you've got to have a reason for curtailing it. What's the reason here?
My understanding of the reason is that the surveillance started becoming a hindrance to the overall process of the case.
That's pretty vague. Specifically what?
The two contempt citations that were brought were both against the respondent mother and her mother for incidences that may not necessarily have been detrimental to the child. If the respondent mother was in violation of a court order, that's obviously an important factor for the court to consider and information that he needs to have. The issue then became, after two such motions, how far is too far? The same case is cited by Mr. Pierman, and one of them was the U.S. v. Katz case, did even in those cases require some limitation in scope on the duration of surveillance and a specific purpose to have that surveillance. So we didn't.
Part of it's the use to which the information is put. Basically, the surveillance reports come in, and it looks like perhaps there were some ill-advised motions for contempt that were filed here.
Correct.
Was there evidence or some indication that the fact of surveillance itself, that the activity was causing people to be uncomfortable around the kids, or that were limiting their freedom of visitation or any of that sort of thing?
There was, and I don't believe this evidence came out in the evidentiary hearing, but there was some reports from the respondent mother and her mother, who's special respondent AS, that they were uncomfortable in their dealings with respondent father AW. They did still have joint decision making with the child. They still had parenting time they had to share with him, and they felt uncomfortable in having those interactions and having those exchanges.
Ms. Andres, I just wanted to alert you to the fact that there are now about 9 minutes and 35 seconds, and you indicated that you and Ms. Huffman were going to divide your time equally.
Right, and I just wanted to make sure that court had no further questions on the surveillance issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, my name is Julie Huffman, and I'm the guardian ad litem for the children in this case. My bar number is 39231. Just quickly to follow up on the court's questions regarding the surveillance, I do recall the court made specific findings at the dispositional stage following the trial. The court stated that this was such a contentious divorce in the DR case and such a contentious environment now in the DNN, he expressly stated on the record that he wanted to set the example for the parties that now, after the trial, this was a time to move forward in rebuilding those relationships, those familial relationships, and that the surveillance was certainly not helping the parties move forward in a manner of trust.
Did the court specify why it reached that conclusion?
The evidence was clear that the parties involved, he emphasized the purpose of the dependency neglect cases to strengthen the family. It was obvious that these parents were extremely polarized, and that he kind of lectured everybody that now is the time, okay, we've got through the adjudication, now's the time to move forward and heal these relationships, and the surveillance is not helping. So I, as the judge, am going to set the example and order there be no more surveillance to try to get these parties to come back together in a trust manner.
Now, let me make sure I understand who is conducting the surveillance and with what goal. As I understand, the grandparents were conducting a surveillance with regard to the mother.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, because they did not trust that she was obeying the court's orders. Now, you'll note from my response brief that I was not going to argue Mr. Pierman's issue, because for me as the GAL, any information about the care of a child, whether it's through surveillance or other means, is helpful to me. So I didn't necessarily argue with him on that point. But I wanted to clarify for the court, there was a reason for the judge's order regarding the surveillance. With respect to the conflicting roles between the CFI, Cheryl Young, and then her role as an expert in the DNN, I do not believe that she was in contravention of CJD 0408. I think it's clear that once the dependency and neglect case is over, there's certainly a problem with her returning to the role of CFI. However, I do not find anything in Chief Judge Directive 0408 that would prevent her from serving in the capacity that she did in the dependency and neglect case. Further, I would cite CJD 0408 paragraph 1, which states violation of a standard should not in and of itself give rise to a cause of action or create a presumption that a legal duty or breach of professional ethics has occurred. They should be interpreted with reference to the purpose of a CFI as defined by statute. Of course, both the Children's Code and the Uniform Dissolution of Marriage Act, both the purpose behind both of those is to serve the best interests of children. This dependency and neglect case arose from her work as the CFI. It was natural that she then be a witness. The fact that she was an expert witness comes from her credentials, which are extremely sound. She's extremely qualified, which is why she's a CFI. If you'll note from the CFI, again, the CJD, certain trainings are required to even be a CFI. So it certainly furthered the purpose of both the Children's Code and the UDMA.
Ms. Huffman, I know this is like the third or fourth time I'm asking a similar question. Are you aware of any DNN published cases that deal with a CFI who was involved in a dissolution of marriage case and then later in a DNN case?
I'm not familiar with any such cases.
Okay, thank you.
I would now just turn briefly to the issue of what Mr. Cervell briefly touched on and Ms. Baker briefly touched on, this idea of an inconsistent verdict form with the no-fault provision added. I think no basis from which either party can assert that should not have been included in the verdict form. Clearly, the department alleged that as a basis for dependency and neglect, therefore, it was proper that it be added to the verdict form. They don't argue that the manner in which it was broken out was improper. They both concede that it was necessary in order to determine the jury's finding. But in that it created some sort of inconsistent verdict simply cannot be the case, given that the terms proper parental care and proper care, only proper parental care is defined by statute. Proper care is not. And in the course of the jury's deliberations, they asked the question twice to us and to the court, what definition should we apply to that? We could not reach a consensus between us what the answer should be, and therefore the judge instructed the jury that they would need to decide for themselves.
You think that verdicts are inconsistent?
I do not. If the jury gave a different definition to the term proper care, which we don't know. We don't know what definition they gave.
Explain that to me. What do you mean?
So proper parental care is defined by statute, clearly, and that the jury was instructed. The term proper care, as stated in paragraph 5F, we call it 5F, the no-fault provision, is not defined by statute. So the jury very wisely came back during their deliberations with a question for us, what is the definition of proper care? We couldn't agree, so the answer was returned back to them, you will have to decide. They came back a second time and said, is the definition of proper care the same as proper parental care? Again, we could not reach a consensus among us ourselves, so the answer went back a second time, you will have to decide for yourselves the definition of proper care. If the jury gave the term proper care the same definition of proper parental care, then it may create an inconsistent verdict form. If they gave it a different definition, then it does not, and we don't know what definition they gave it. It's not clear in statute. I think that one thing this court could do in this case is help clarify that ambiguity in the children's code, because it's a problem.
I'm wondering if you can posit for me a sort of evidentiary or, you know, narrative here that would allow the jury to reach the conclusion that there was proper care but not proper parental care. What could be, what story could be in the jury's mind? What version of events would yield this observation?
I argued when the questions were presented that the terms should be synonymous. However, a situation not present here but could arise is if it wasn't a parent who was providing the care at the time the DNN was filed. Many times children are not in the care of their parents. So if you impute the term parental on anyone caring for a child,
we have a problem.
Then we have a problem.
Okay.
If it's another, if it's a grandmother, if it's an aunt or an uncle or even a neighbor, do you impute the word parental into the word proper care? Now, it could be a child is living not with either parent and is found to lack proper care through no fault of the parent. The term care, I believe, is synonymous with that defined in the statute as proper parental care. Essentially, we're talking about the basic care any child needs to thrive and be healthy and safe. So whether provided by a parent or another caregiver, I argue the definition is the same. But because it's not clear in statute, we can't instruct the jury to what it should be. So I do think that is one very helpful thing this court could do in this case for future cases. I would respond briefly to Mr. Kidney's argument regarding the competency and unavailability issue. I do agree with Judge Russell's questions to him. I believe that the competency issue relates only to unavailability and not to reliability. And I say that, first of all, because, he argues that competency had to be determined, the reason for her incompetency had to be determined by the judge. I disagree. When all the parties stipulate the child's incompetent, there's no reason for the judge to have an evidentiary hearing on the issue. It's been stipulated. She's unavailable because she's incompetent.
But Ms. Hoffman, let me just ask you about that. As I understand Mr. Kidney's argument, it's that at some point a child is so young that the child may not be able to adequately describe what he or she saw. So if you had a six-month-old, for example, presumably everybody would agree that that child couldn't participate and give useful information.
But I think that's different than saying that, I think, again, Judge Russell's idea that it's different, that what you're saying is she's unreliable. Her statements, she's so young that what she's saying is unreliable. That's different than being competent to sit on a witness stand and have questions directed at her and recall from memory times and dates and facts versus a child who is playing on the floor with the CFI and starts talking about sexual abuse acts that she's witnessed or experienced. I would reference People v. Diefenderfer, 784 P. 2nd, 741. Statements of a very young child related to incidents of sexual abuse tend to be reliable. That's different than, is she competent to sit on a witness stand and take in information posed to her? Again, the same case, a child who is not competent to testify is unavailable. Competent to testify is different than, is she too young to really be believable? That's a reliability issue.
Okay. I think your time is up. Thank you very much. We have a couple of concluding matters before we completely wrap up. First of all, I want to compliment all of you six attorneys. It's not often that we have six lawyers for one set of oral arguments. I thought you all did a very excellent job in participating in the oral arguments. I also want to compliment you on the quality of all of your briefs in this case. We don't often see petitions on appeal and responses to them of this quality in DNN cases. So we really appreciate that. I also want to thank Mr. Kidney, Ms. Baker, Ms. Andos, and Ms. Hoffman for traveling all the way here for the oral arguments this afternoon. We appreciate it, and we know how far away you had to come for the arguments. Finally, before you leave, there is an order to show cause directed to you, Mr. Kidney, about the timeliness of your notice of cross appeal, and it's for you to respond to within a week, and there are copies for all the other counsel. It relates to the question of whether or not what you denominated as a notice of cross appeal was properly a cross appeal, and if not, whether your notice was one day late under the rules. We haven't decided that issue, of course, but we have noticed it as a possible issue, and therefore we would like you to respond in writing by a week from today. Is that time okay for you to respond?
Yeah, that's fine. Thanks, Judge. And just while you're addressing, you know, I think I gave you the wrong site to that transcript. Could I just correct that real quickly?
Sure.
You asked me about the issue of competency, and when did I refer to the judge? And it would be the January 4th hearing. It's kind of right around pages 30 to 34. I think I gave you.
You said 132 to 133.
Yeah, and that's fine. I'll respond
in.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So if all of the six of you could get a copy of that order to show cause from the bailiff on your way out, we would appreciate it. So thank you all again for your very capable arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.